In the news.
All right, welcome. I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. We welcome you to another installment of In the News for American and Texas Government. Today we're going to discuss four topics. The first topic will be the Senate's vote on gun control. Follow that, we'll give you an update on the future of the Sanders campaign, followed by a discussion of an idea that's been introduced in the House and in the Senate that looks like it's moving forward, and that is the drafting of women, or making women eligible for the draft. And finally, we'll move to Texas, where we'll talk about Texas and its suit against the federal government and regarding the location of Syrian refugees. But first, let's start off with the gun control vote, which happened in the Senate. And so in reaction to the shootings in Orlando, there's a great deal of pressure put on Congress to do something about gun control. And there's actually a 15-hour filibuster by members of the Democratic Party led by Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut. We have a video real quick which talks about the filibuster.
Over just the past 5 years, lawmakers have introduced more than 100 gun control proposals in Congress. Not one of them has been passed into law. In fact, very few of the proposals even made it to the House or Senate floor. On Monday evening, the Senate is slated to vote on four more. Democrats have proposed two, one that would ban suspected terrorists from being able to purchase a gun, and another that would expand background checks. Those two proposals, plus two less restrictive measures offered by Republicans, are all expected to fail. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, scheduled the four votes after Democrats pressured Republicans to take action on guns in the wake of the June 12th Orlando shooting that left 49 people dead and 53 wounded.
So as you see, this vote was put forward. This was a vote that happened on Monday night. And this is again after a 15-hour filibuster just to force the vote. And there are four measures put forward. The first one, which I'll discuss, was from Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican from Iowa. And this failed in a 53-47 vote. And we'll talk about that, why, even though he received 53 positive votes, it still failed. We'll talk about that in just a second. But Senator Grassley's was to increase funding for background checks and change the language barring people with mental health issues from buying a gun. Now, Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut, who led the filibuster, his fail was 44 positive votes, 56 negative votes, and he argued for expanding background checks to the sales of firearms at gun shows and on the internet. So this has been seen as a huge loophole, the fact that you can do them through background checks for guns sold at gun shows or over the internet. Third, we have Senator Dianne Feinstein, which hers failed 47-53, where it let the Justice Department ban gun sales to anyone who is on the terrorist watch list in the past 5 years. So this has been one of the arguments that if you're on the terrorist watch list, you cannot purchase a gun. Again, there's been pushback on this specifically because it's seen as violating due process. And this is, you're suspected of a crime, you've not been convicted of a crime, but you're being treated as a criminal. And finally, from our own Texas Senator John Cornyn, his failed 53-47, allowed the government to block gun sales for up to 3 days pending a court review. Furthermore, the government would also have to show probable cause that the prospective gun buyer was involved in terrorist activities. And so what you see coming out of these minis is, look, if you're seen as some type of terrorist, something like that, seen as a threat to the nation, you should not be allowed to buy a gun. So as many people have said, this is a issue of, if you can't fly on a plane, why should we allow you to buy a gun? So in many ways, it's a way about keeping guns away from terrorists. And while we're focusing on international terrorists, we're also concerned about domestic terrorists as well. Now, again, all four failed. And as you see on the cover from the New York Daily News, again, a very strong response to this of saying the Senate votes in favor of continued mass killings, where you see this very strong negative reaction to what happened in the Senate. But what we want to talk about is, why is that the case? Why is it that you had two of these proposals that had the majority, that had 50% plus one, but still failed? And one of the things that's really important to talk about here is really the rules in the Senate, specifically in regards to the filibuster and cloture.
Yeah, so look, there's a couple of different issues that are going on here. And we'll talk a little bit about the politics when we get to more of our round robin phase of the discussion in the news. But we did want to set the parameters, since this is a high-profile example of Congress considering a piece of legislation to deal with a public policy issue in the United States, in this case, gun control. So a lot of the things we've been talking about in the modules, interest groups, so the National Rifle Association versus victims' rights groups, versus more progressive-leaning groups. They are both kind of arrayed on this issue with very, very different perspectives on these. However, you know, they take their fight to the Congress. And in the Congress, you know, the House is what we call a majoritarian institution. Basically, if you've got 50 plus one votes, you're going to do pretty well. The Senate, in a lot of ways, is not a majoritarian institution. And that may come as a surprise to some of you who haven't really done any kind of detailed studies of the Congress. But when we say it's not a majoritarian institution, what we mean is that there are institutional arrangements within the Senate. They're agreed upon arrangements. They're not in the Constitution. They're simply kind of rules of order within the Senate that guide how things happen. And one of those rules, and this is where we'll get into some of the definitions here, one of those rules is that if you gain the floor of the Senate, so go back to your black and white catalog and look up the old James Stewart movie, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. By the way, you should watch that anyway. It's a really great movie. But one of the things that you'll see in that movie is Jimmy Stewart as this, you know, freshman senator who conducts this filibuster. A filibuster with an F, not a PH. That's a sure way to a D minus on your test, right? With an F, filibuster, F-I-L-I-B-U-S-T-E-R, filibuster. What that means is that you gain control from the Senate floor and nobody can interrupt, nobody can stop your control. They cannot do anything until you relinquish control of the floor. Now, it's an institutional maneuver. You have to keep speaking, or at least, you know, you cannot be formally interrupted. If you do, then you lose control, and whoever gains the floor can sort of get back on whatever order of business they want. But a filibuster basically brings the Senate to a halt, and it's just an arrangement. It's not a particularly American arrangement. You know, the word filibuster comes from legislative processes in some other countries, but we've adopted it here. So you may be asking, well, how does this ever stop? All right, well, the only way to end a filibuster is through a vote of cloture, C-L-O-T-U-R-E, cloture. Now, how do you do a vote of cloture, or what's required? You need 60 votes. So there's 100 senators. If you get 60 of them to vote cloture, you end a filibuster. So when people talk about the Republicans and the Democrats in the Senate, and they talk about, well, the Republicans have a majority, but the Democrats can filibuster, and the Republicans, who right now have, what is it, 54 or 53?
I think it's 54.
I think it's 54 seats in the Senate. They've got enough for a majority, but they can't shut down a filibuster. You know, they need some Democratic votes to do that. This is really important a few years ago during Obamacare, when it was considered by the Senate. The Republicans, you know, they didn't have a majority, but when Ted Kennedy died and the Republicans won that seat in a shocking upset in Massachusetts, they had enough votes to, you know, prevent a vote of cloture, which meant they could filibuster Obamacare, right? So that was a big deal, right? So in this case, there were a bunch of proposals out of the four that Professor McDaniel mentioned. There were a couple that had majority support, but they didn't have enough to override a filibuster, to engage in a vote of cloture. So essentially all of them ended up dying. Nobody wanted to press it because they didn't have the magic 60, right? So they didn't even try. Now, by the way, a filibuster today is not what it used to be. Back in the old days, and you'll actually see this in some of the classic movies I mentioned, you know, the person would speak and speak and speak, but they had to keep speaking. They could not, you know, take a bathroom break. They had to keep going until they physically wore down, at which point, you know, they would collapse and be carried off and the Senate would go on and do its business, right? That's not the way it is today. And actually, I'm very much opposed to that. I think if you're going to have a silly institution like the filibuster, but you ought to at least make it, you know, a real, real, you know, kind of manly filibuster, right? Where you hold that floor until you drop dead. Now that's sort of proving your point on principle. Nowadays, they take bathroom breaks. You can actually do rotating filibusters if there's agreement. So one guy can get up and talk for a while, and then a woman can come and take over. And it's lost all of its, you know, kind of aura.
It's like tag team wrestling.
Yeah, it's just it's not quite as interesting as it used to be, right? But again, why is it that the rules have changed? It's by mutual agreement of Republicans and Democrats in the Senate. So they could end the filibuster as an institutional arrangement tomorrow if they wanted to. But neither party wants to because they're always afraid they're going to be in the majority and the minority one day, and they want a filibuster to be able to prevent legislation that they think is particularly onerous. Now, I was, you know, kind of ragging on the filibuster there a few minutes ago, but if you wanted to defend it, you'd say, well, it preserves the rights of minorities, or minority party, I should say, right? So the framers of the Constitution didn't want tyrannies of the majority. They didn't want popular positions to be able to just run roughshod over minority positions. And so, you know, the filibuster is an institutional way to protect minorities, even though they don't have a majority of public opinion, from, you know, just getting ramrodded, right? So that's kind of why it exists. Anyway, this was the latest example. But what that means is that for a piece of gun control legislation or any other substantive piece of legislation to get a bill out of the Senate, you basically need the support of 60 members, because if you've got 40 who oppose it, they can filibuster and you can't engage in a vote of cloture to shut them down. Right. So that's kind of where we are on that. Now, with respect to gun control itself, it's still an interesting issue. You notice, as Professor McDaniel mentioned, like the Cornyn Amendment, John Cornyn, our own senator here from Texas, you know, he had a thing in there that said you need a court order in order to establish that there was a reason to deny.
Three-day
check. And if the court can't produce evidence that the person is actually engaged in terrorist activities, then they go ahead and get the gun, right? So that's obviously a very, you know, from the pro-gun side of the aisle, Cornyn's amendment is designed to protect those rights, right? But then on the other hand, you know, you had the Connecticut senator whose position was almost an outright closure of the loopholes, right, when it comes to gun shows and internet sales, right? So, by the way, the left and the right are just talking past each other right now in a lot of ways. I think some Republicans have figured out that in some ways, they're on the wrong side of the gun control issue. Not maybe broadly, but they are on the defense when it comes to some of these semi-automatic weapons and military-style rifles and things like that. That, you know, there's significant majorities of opinion that we ought to close loopholes and make those less available. All right. By the way, we'll also loop you guys back just to touch base with some of the broader points we've made in the course. This, like First Amendment issues, like some of the search and seizure issues, this is a case in which we're still trying to define the Constitution, right? There is constitutional right to bear arms and to arm the militia, but where does that end? I mean, everybody acknowledges there's got to be some limits. There's no guaranteed right for an insane person, whether a citizen or not, to have access to a bazooka. But short of that, where do we stop? Where do we draw the line? Do we have a right to automatic? What about semi-automatic? What about certain kinds of rifles? You know, what sorts of accoutrements on the rifle or the gun are allowed? Are any of them allowed under the Second Amendment, or is that just something else? Okay, so all of this stuff, we're still figuring out. Just like we know there are limits on free speech, we know there are limits on guns, but there's not a lot of agreement on where to draw those lines. And it'll probably change over time.
Yeah, and it's something that's going back and forth. Now, one thing that's also important to note about this, and again, talking about the way Congress operates, is that even if you did have 60 votes coming out and it wasn't able to get out of the Senate, it would still go to the House, or many people thought it would just die, it would die in the House. So just because, I mean, it was started in the Senate, then it would move to the House can make changes and then maybe kill it there, make changes that the Senate hates, and it would be killed there. So the probability of this getting through was slow to begin with, but in many ways it was a symbolic vote. And that's what many people are arguing, is that when Senator Murphy was calling for this vote, he knew it was going to get voted down, but he wanted something on the record. Because as the video showed, many of these have not even gotten to a floor vote. And so for the most part, they're killed in committee. They haven't gotten to a floor vote. So he was really trying to force a floor vote. And I think in many ways to really say, okay, I'm drawing the line in the sand. Who's with me? Who's against me? And in the middle of a campaign, this is something you could use to clearly stake out, here's where I stand on the policies. Here's where this other person stands on the policies.
And I think on the Democratic side, they wanted Republicans on record opposing certain kinds of gun control, because they think it's going to be difficult to defend that, you know, in the context of several mass shootings in an election year, as Professor McDaniel mentioned.
And tangential to this is the Supreme Court refused to listen to an appeal towards a Connecticut law which bans semi-automatic weapons. So in response to Sandy Hook, Connecticut banned certain semi-automatic weapons. Citizens of the state sued, arguing this violated their Second Amendment rights. The Supreme Court basically went with the lower court's decision, said we won't hear this, and upheld that law by saying we will not hear this. And so when the Supreme Court says we won't hear this, it basically means we don't see any reason to change, or there's not enough reason for us to review this. So the lower court's ruling stands, which means that that Connecticut law still remains in effect.
Yeah. All right, now I guess what we want to do now is transition to the second topic, which is the continued candidacy of Bernie Sanders, our favorite Vermont Social Democrat. So we have a video kind of queuing up where we stand with respect to feeling the burn this week.
We must continue our grassroots effort to create the America that we know we can become. And we must take that energy into the Democratic National Convention on July 25th in Philadelphia, where we will have more than 1,900 delegates. I recently had the opportunity to meet with Secretary Clinton and discuss some of the very important issues facing our country and the Democratic Party. It is no secret that Secretary Clinton and I have strong disagreements on some very, very important issues. It is also true that our views are quite close on others. I look forward in the coming weeks to continued discussion between the two campaigns. I also look forward to working with Secretary Clinton to transform the Democratic Party so that it becomes a party of working people and young people and not just wealthy campaign contributors. A party that has the guts to take on Wall Street, the pharmaceutical industry, the fossil fuel industry, and the other powerful special interests that dominate so much of our political and economic life.
Well, there's Bernie clarifying why he continues to, you know, be an active candidate despite the fact that Hillary Clinton has clinched the Democratic nomination in terms of, as best we can tell, delegates, and even she's actually got a majority of pledged delegates, and she also has an outright majority when you call into account superdelegates. So people are starting to ask, why is the Bernster still involved in this race? And, you know, I think there are a lot of people who think that he actually had more leverage when he was kind of effectively contesting primaries than he does now. The smart set in Washington and New York are kind of the opinion that Bernie is less relevant by the day and actually has less leverage now than he did a couple of weeks ago. So what does he want? I mean, I get the sense that two things are going on. The first is that he doesn't want to be the vice president. I don't think that's his gig. And Hillary is not going to have Bernie as the vice president. He wants to have an impact on the Democratic platform. That's the National Party's statement of principles and issue positions that they draft every 4 years at the National Convention. That's unquestionably true. There's also some sense, and this is kind of, you know, it's rumor and innuendo, so I will feel free to dispense it to you, and that is that there are people close to Bernie, his wife and his main advisor, who believe that Hillary Clinton will be indicted. What that means is that if Bernie suspends his campaign, he can continue to raise money, but he's not an active candidate. All right. Now, at this point, he's raised a ton of money, so I'm not quite sure what that would give him. But if he suspends his campaign, he basically kind of cedes the field to Hillary Clinton. If he doesn't suspend the campaign, if he keeps it active, then I think the logic is he is the most logical candidate if Hillary Clinton, because of the email and the server scandal, gets recommended by the FBI to be indicted by the Justice Department. By the way, the FBI could recommend indicting Hillary Clinton, and the Justice Department could decline to do so. It's very unclear what the FBI is going to do or whether they'll do it before the election. If they were to recommend indictment, it's completely unclear that the Justice Department would take that seriously. But if the FBI did that, though, it would be a big deal. There would be Democrats and others who would say that Hillary should step down. And I think one of the reasons Bernie's staying in the race as an active candidate is that it sets him apart from people like Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren, who weren't candidates, as the logical heir. All right, so that's my 2 cents worth. Again, a lot of this is me just spitballing from, you know, 1,200 miles away, but I got nothing better to do. It's like 100 degrees outside, so I'll engage in rumor and innuendo. So any thoughts on, as I said, our favorite senator from Vermont?
Well, I mean, again, you have maple syrup and you have Bernie, two of the greatest things the Vermont's ever given us. And again, nothing against Vermont. My first job talk was at the University of Vermont.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Did you get the offer?
Oh, God, no.
What are you going to do?
Well, I was kind of glad because I got the wake-up call and it said you'll be greeted to 6 to 8 inches of snow. I was like, that's not a greeting. Yeah. That's like saying the Klan will greet you as you get off the plane. All right, so no, I wasn't happy about that at all. But with that being said, Bernie Sanders is really painting this as a social movement, as a broader social movement. And he's saying that he's going to carry the social movement into the Democratic Party. And again, you see the same thing in the 60s where you saw this push in terms of trying to change the Democratic Party. You've also seen this in the Republican Party where conservatives have said, no, this is what I want the party to be in the future. Now, the thing that hurts Bernie, again, as I've said over and over again, is that he became a Democrat a year ago. While he caucused with the Democrats, he worked with the Democrats in terms of actually identifying as one, he didn't. And so he's trying to change a party that he just became a member of. And so many people aren't that happy about that. So it's kind of like getting a new roommate who wants to change all the furniture. It's like, hey, Hoss, you just got here. And so that becomes problematic. But what also may be seen as problematic about this is also about Bernie Sanders' campaign. Is if you listen to the rhetoric of Hillary Clinton, it's more of let's bring Wall Street and everybody together to make sure everybody's voices are heard. Whereas Bernie Sanders really seems to be pitting in us versus them arguments. So he says young people, working class, that we take on Wall Street, we take on the pharmaceutical companies, as if you know those are the enemies. And just as much as we've criticized individuals such as Ted Cruz or Donald Trump for this language of saying there are only certain Americans that are important, you see the same thing coming out of Bernie Sanders, and this may hurt him in the end. Whereas Hillary Clinton's is more of a, hey, let's bring everybody together. And the problem, many people argue, is that her argument of bringing everybody together means that Wall Street may continue winning more than it should, and the other people are forgotten. They're there symbolically, where policy-wise, Wall Street wins. It's not really clear, but it is very clear within his language, he's staking out, like, these are my people, those are your people, us versus them. And this is kind of how he's gone about in terms of the campaign as well, saying, look, we're the new progressives versus the old establishment, which has been bought up by special interests.
No, I think this is an important question. I mean, some of you may be asking, why is Hillary Clinton even concerned about Bernie Sanders? I mean, she's got the nomination. Can't she blow him off? And it's a legitimate question. It's not clear to me Bernie Sanders is going to be able to deliver. The demography of the Democratic primary was essentially Bernie Sanders was dominating amongst white voters, especially white voters under 45 years of age, right? That's sort of his crowd. Hillary Clinton did really, really well with African Americans, with older people of all races and ethnicities, right? And she did pretty well with Hispanics too, although it varied a little bit how much, you know, how big her advantage was sort of location by location, right? But do we really think that Bernie can deliver younger voters? You know, those of you out there who are Sanders supporters, if Sanders were to, you know, drop out tomorrow and say, I am endorsing Hillary Clinton, go out and work for Hillary, you know, support Hillary, would that mean a lot to you? You know, and part of it is, as Professor McDaniel said, the rhetoric and the issue agenda. You know, are you all out there who are Sanders supporters convinced that Hillary is really down for the revolution? And a lot of people aren't. I mean, you know, she's, as many people have pointed out, she has been very close to Wall Street for a long time. Her husband's administration, you know, wasn't all that hostile to Wall Street. Wall Street did pretty well by the Clintons, and the Clintons have done pretty well by Wall Street. So, you know, so there's an ambivalence. So that's why this dance is going on. Hillary would really like that support. She'd like that enthusiasm, but tapping into it, it's a little tough. So Bernie's trying to keep that card and play it for all it's worth, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's going to be interesting how this plays out moving into the convention. I clearly believe that he will be able to influence the platform, but to what degree he'll be able to drastically change it isn't really clear.
Yeah, and platforms don't necessarily mean very much either these days. Yeah, they used to mean a lot, not so much anymore. By the way, Democrats in Philadelphia, they'll go second, right? They're the incumbent party, so they go second, just by kind of tradition, I guess, right? There's a soda tax in Philly, just went into effect, so that's going to hurt those Democrats. And Republicans are in Cleveland, where presumably everybody's fat and happy, you know, with LeBron James highs and stuff like that going on. So
that's right. Yeah. Everybody's trying to resurrect their burned jerseys. Now, the next topic we're going to move on to is something that may have passed by that you may not have noticed, but the idea of women being in the draft. And in the Senate vote over the National Defense Authorization Act, which is a $602 billion defense spending for the 2017 fiscal year, there was a clause added which required women to register for the draft, and this would only be for women who turn 18 after December 31st, 2017. So basically, if you turn 18 on January 1st, 2018 or later, you are required to register for the draft. And what's interesting about this is that Republicans were split on this. And even when they voted on it at the level, there were only maybe 13 votes against it. And at the committee level, Republicans were split over this provision, where there are 14 on the committee, there are 7-7. So you have Senator Ted Cruz, our own Senator Ted Cruz from Texas, speaking out against it, but then you have Senator John McCain speaking out in favor of it. Now, what's important to note about this is that this idea actually started in the House, where somebody introduced it for the House's version of the spending bill, really as a way to basically poke fun at the idea of making women register for the draft.
That's Duncan Hunter, right?
Yes.
That's my old representative from San Diego way back in the day.
So he put it, because he's a combat veteran. He's against the idea of women serving in combat. So he put it out there thinking, okay, this will force us to talk about drafting women, and basically we'll say, okay, this will get rid of the conversation. What actually happened is it snowballed in the other direction. People, the more they talked about it, they're like, oh, this is a good idea. Now, eventually it was stripped from the House's version of the appropriations bill, but it popped up on the Senate's version of the bill. Now, what's also important to understand is that, again, talking about how things work through Congress, is that now it goes to the conference committee, which is a joint session of members of the House and members of the Senate, where they take a look at the bill and see what they like, what they don't like, and then try to change the bill so it fits both of them. And so it could be stripped at that moment. And then again, it's voted again by the House, voted again by the Senate, and then it goes up to the president. But there's a good chance the president may veto this appropriations bill because he's not happy about certain provisions, specifically about not being able to close Guantanamo, as well as them restricting the president from closing down military bases that really are not that important, that are kind of superfluous, and again, as a try to shrink the military's budget.
But those are general concerns about the appropriations bill, though, right? Does Obama have any objections to, by the way, this is women registering for the Selective Service, right?
Yes.
Which is what, you know, we all had to do back in the day. But now guys still register for the Selective Service, but they're talking about expanding that. So those of you out there are freaking out right now. Well, you're past the deadline, so you're probably okay.
But, yeah, you've already
registered. But it's registering for the draft. They're not talking about a draft, right? It's just putting women into the pool. Right. But has Obama come out as saying anything, whether he's pro or against the women in the draft?
And that's what I've really been looking into, and there's really nothing clear about that. I've been trying to figure out where the president stood on this. Now, what's also missing in this, and any of you who watched Samantha Bee's show Full Frontal, was in the appropriations bill, was an attempt to change the way in which the military courts deal with rape in the military. And they're pushing for that. That also failed. And so there are various aspects of this where people may want to strike down little bits of it. Again, this is where you see a lot of action being put in with appropriations bills saying we're giving this money, but we're giving this money and you need to do A, B, C, and D. So appropriations bills where you really need to pay attention to the kind of small details, the small clauses put in there that if you're not paying attention will become extremely important a decade later. Now, if you look at public opinion regarding drafting women, what we see is it's about 49% of the public supports having women open for the draft. We see 61% of men support making women eligible for the draft, and 38% of women support this.
There's a shocker.
Yeah, and this is an interesting thing because with the Equal Rights Amendment of the late 70s, early 80s, there was a fear that if you passed the Equal Rights Amendment, that women would now be eligible for the draft. And you had some people were torn over this. And again, I was doing a little bit of research on this just to see where the feminist position was on this. And some of the arguments were that pacifist feminists were opposed to this because that would mean women would now be put into an activity that they were opposed to because they're pacifist. It's one of those very weird things. And again, what may also be important to look at this is, you know, if we account for things such as support, the morality of war and things like that, we may find that the gap between men and women disappear. That because women may have lower support for the morality of warfare than men, but this may be what's driving it. But this is a much longer look, and you know, something I can work on as I try to work my way to full professor. But the key thing here is we do see this split within the public, and also we see that, you know, there are splits between Republicans and Democrats. Democrats are a little bit more supportive of this than Republicans. But it is something that's going to be talked about quite a bit. And again, as we talk about the idea of gender equality, equal pay, there are some important things we need to think about in terms of the place of men and women in the workforce and what does that equality mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real interesting question. I mean, one of the things is, as you talk about women in the military, there's a question of sort of combat versus non-combat or combat versus supporting role. And this, as far as I can tell, this doesn't distinguish, because this is not a you're going to be drafted, it's simply registering for some kind of prospective draft at some point in the future. So, you know, the feminist position, I think, is muddled because they're not quite sure what they think on this. And I mean, it's reasonable that it would be, right? I mean, on the one hand, I think there's a sense that, you know, women can do anything that men can do, and certainly the, you know, performance of women in the Gulf and in Afghanistan and other places indicates that, you know, in a volunteer setting, this has worked pretty well. You know, if we move to a draft setting, I think there are questions about it. I hadn't thought of the pacifist angle. I'm not quite sure how that's more appropriate for men or women. I don't quite get that. And I'm not as interested in you doing research on that. But it is fascinating, you know, this comes up, as Professor McDaniel mentioned, as part of a larger appropriations bill, right? So this is the kind of stuff that gets stuck into the military appropriations bill all the time, right? You know, weapons systems, and the Republicans have put in this, you know, part of the military appropriations bill. The president can't close Guantanamo. That's why he wants to veto this bill, irrespective of the dollars allocated to certain things. It's because it's got sort of this, what we call poison pills, that the president doesn't want any part of. So, but it's a really interesting sort of public policy debate. You know, I've been reading some stuff on World War II right now, and one of the things that's interesting in contrast to what we've got here is this question whether women should serve in the military has not been an issue in other places in the world for a long time. The Russians had, you know, a complete draft, you know, in World War II, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of women were killed, even in support roles. And some women were not just in support roles, there were women in combat roles. So it's interesting the United States is finally getting around to a real serious debate on this.
Yeah, I mean, and there was an idea of drafting women in World War II because they needed more nurses.
Right.
I mean, again, what's important to note is there's been a drastic change in the U.S. military where in late 2015, President Obama basically stripped the idea of women not serving in combat roles. So women can serve in any role whatsoever. So you have women graduating from the Ranger School,
yep,
things like that. So you're now seeing women enter combat roles, and this is kind of pushing it forward. And while, again, the person who introduced this was against the idea of women serving in combat roles, what he thought would be a way to, your thought-provoking idea to get us to really talk about this, actually backfired on him on that.
Do we want to whipsaw through this last topic here?
Oh, yeah. So the last one we have for you today, bringing it back home to Texas, as we always do. And again, this deals with, surprise, surprise, Texas suing the federal government.
What?
I know.
I can't believe
Texas sued the federal government? You know, so this is dealing with the Syrian refugees. And so we have a real quick clip which describes the response.
Texas has lost its bid to keep Syrian refugees out when a federal judge on Thursday dismissed the state's lawsuit over resettlement from the war-torn Middle East country. U.S. District Court Judge David Godbee said the state failed to make a plausible claim for relief in its lawsuit against the federal government and the International Rescue Committee, a charity that aids refugees. Texas officials argue that they should be consulted by the federal government before refugees are relocated there, and that the state should be provided with specific information about individual refugees. But the judge said that existing U.S. law does not support the state's petition, a ruling that was cheered by the plaintiffs.
So what's going on is Texas is arguing that the way the federal government is going about the resettlement of Syrian refugees in the U.S. violates the Refugee Act of 1980, which points out that the federal government should consult regularly with the states for this. And so this is what's prompting Texas, what Texas is using as support for why the federal government should not be allowed just to automatically put the refugees in the state. And this has been a really big issue. I think one of the big problems is people are not really sure of what the screening process is. And you're hearing a lot during the campaign. There actually is a YouTube video from the Department of Homeland Security which talks about the screening process and which kind of goes into great detail and actually points out that refugees from Syria actually go under a more stringent screening process than others, where they're fingerprinted and their fingerprints go through a database basically over and over again to see if they're linked to terrorists. But there are still concerns about, you know, who's coming over. While we know for the most part it's women and children, there are fears that other people are coming in that may have hostile interests to the U.S., and especially after the attacks in Paris, that has really heightened the concerns that some of these refugees may actually have ill intent towards the United States.
Yeah, look, I think it can get lost in some of the rhetoric of the presidential campaign where, you know, Donald Trump says something about banning Muslim immigration, at least temporarily, which is what, you know, the Donald said. I think Trump's words were, until we figure out what the hell is going on. That was kind of Trump's position on this. The Texas position here we want to emphasize involves a federalist argument or a federalism argument, and that is the role, proper role of the state versus the federal government in setting policy. And on the one hand, it makes sense that the federal government would have a greater say in determining these sorts of international questions about the nature of international immigration. On the other hand, Texas is right in suggesting that, you know, the governor and executive in Texas are charged with protecting the people of Texas, just as the president is charged with protecting the people of the United States. And if the federal government sort of relocates people from Syria, is it unreasonable for the state of Texas to want to be more kind of regularly and substantively consulted on that process? You know, so, well, we joke about it a lot, and Texas does sue the federal government a lot. most of these things aren't really frivolous. They involve important questions. And whether there were Democrats or Republicans in charge of the state of Texas, I think there would still probably be an institutional divide between, you know, hey, we're protecting the state's interest and the federal government is looking out only for, you know, sort of national interest and attempting to expand national authority. So, you know, as for the immigration itself, I don't really know how stringent these are. And I think the objection that Professor McDaniel alluded to is that even going through fingerprint or databases, I mean, how many people in Syria have records of any sort? And does it make sense to limit immigration by gender, by age, by religion, or something like that? And while the way maybe it's framed by some politicians is fairly contentious slash, you know, offensive to some people, these are still interesting questions. And, you know, our sort of role in this class is to put these questions out there and talk about how they're sort of, you know, dealt with by the American public and the American government. So, you know, yet another case of federalism. I tell you, federalism, not a sexy topic, but underrated. You know, kind of sneaky relevant. Sneaky relevant.
Yeah, it's you know, federalism is extremely important. And it's one of the things when we talk about the enforcement of policy and where we see why you see certain things not being passed, federalism comes into place. The reason why you have different drinking laws from state to state, the fact that I can go in Illinois and California, I can walk into CVS, Walgreens, the grocery store, I can pick up some trash bags, some Cheetos, and, you know, and a fifth of Hennessy and walk out perfectly fine, whereas in Texas... And I do regularly because, you know...
Because you can.
I got to take that edge off. Whereas, you know, in Oklahoma, you know, you can only buy a certain beer in the grocery store. Then if you want a higher alcohol limit, you can buy it at the liquor store and it's not refrigerated. These are all about federalism, all parts of different things. Now, I shouldn't admit that I know this much about liquor laws because you might be getting bad ideas about me, but...
Research. It's always research. That's right.
At least that's what I tell my wife. But that's all we have for today. And what I want to do is thank you again for joining us this week. We'll be back next week to talk about more relevant issues. Have a good week.
Stay cool.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.